countries in the world that's failed to ratify an international treaty agreeing not to execute children, and it, of course, is in the good company of Somalia, which we won't even talk about at this time. What I'd like to do is also get some idea of the... What's the time frame here? Is our man Cooper about to be called off to be killed? What's the story?
Yes. Cooper is close to exhausting all of his appeals. He's now down to an appeal before the Ninth Circuit of the Federal Court, and then all that will be remaining is the U.S. Supreme Court. I have a petition drive going to urge the Attorney General, Bill Lockyer, to ensure that DNA testing takes place in this case.
It's his choice?
No, Cooper wants it.
No, but it's Lockyer's choice.
No, but Lockyer could certainly be influential and encourage the governor if we have to go to the clemency phase to do that.
We know how compassionate
yes.
the governor is.
Yes, we do.
He goes after vets with post-traumatic stress disorder. And
yes, in both of the two executions that have taken place this year, J.C. Lapong and Manny Babbitt, if there were ever reasons for clemency, and clemency is about mercy, by the way, both of those men were excellent candidates for mercy, and neither of them got it. So clemency is a farce. The appeals are a farce. What we have to do is abolish the death penalty because we cannot let such an error-prone system decide who lives and dies. And we're out of step in the international community in having the death penalty. And this year, for the very first time, Amnesty International targeted the United States for human rights abuses, most of them around our criminal justice system and the way that we deal with immigrants. I'd like to let people know that we have both a website and I have email if people would like to look on the website and see some pictures of Kevin, and he's an accomplished artist. You can view some of his paintings and read some of his essays. And the website is www.activist-etc.org. And I can be reached at email for me is Jody, J-O-D-Y, at activist-etc.org. And I would welcome people contacting me on email if you'd like to make a contribution to the Kevin Cooper Legal Defense Fund. Money is the thing so far that looks like it's going to save Kevin's life, because we raised this money and that led to the investigation, and that's crucial in finding out this information.
And I imagine people can write to him if...
people can absolutely write to him. He's very anxious to hear from people. Very responsive.
You know, let me kind of lead you down another path here for a few moments. You've been a resident of Scotts Valley for some time.
I've lived here in this community since 1981.
Mm-hmm. Did this passion for justice in this case did it come from? I mean, we're talking about a person who's far away from you, who, I don't know, you probably have never met.
Oh, I've met.
You have met?
Oh, yes. I go to the death row, the visiting room at San Quentin Prison and visit Kevin, and I know several other men on death row, and it's very different than what you might expect to go there.
Well, you got a lot of body searches, as I understand.
Yes, the worst part of it is going through the visitor information processing center, which I refer to as the Hall of Tears. And once you get into the visiting room with these men, the fearful part of it is over. And these men are consistently kind, grateful, warm. They're not in any way frightening or scary. It's so different from what our idea is of visiting someone who's, a condemned prisoner. So I regularly visit Cooper.
Well, I remember when I was in jail in San Francisco in 1996 for serving free food, I met some people who were there for murder, and they were just, I mean, they seemed to me like ordinary people, and I wasn't judging them. Generally speaking, guards treated us much worse than the fellow prisoners.
Yes.
There were a couple exceptions. But I guess what I want to ask you is, a lot of the time, this show concerns itself with issues of civil rights for poor people in our community here in Santa Cruz.
Yes.
And I'm concerned with issues like the sleeping ban, like laws that criminalize poor people, really trivial laws if you're looking at a situation where a person's life is at stake in terms of, or their liberty for the rest of their life, like being unjustly jailed for a crime you didn't commit, like murder, and being about to be executed for that crime. or, you know, facing execution, even if you did commit the crime, when we know, at least I agree with you, I think capital punishment is implicitly wrong, but even if it were, even if it weren't, it's administered arbitrarily and unfairly. But I'm also concerned about activists who have a lot of concern about what's happening in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and death row. But when you try to draw their attention to what's going on in the jails in Santa Cruz or on the streets of Santa Cruz, suddenly they are members of the establishment. And I don't know where you stand on this. What do you think of our sleeping ban law here in Santa Cruz, the law that makes it criminal for homeless people to sleep at night?
You know, I haven't actively worked on that particular issue, but I'll step back and tell you what I think about homelessness in general. I think it's appalling that we have homelessness. I think we have far too much money and far too many resources to have homelessness. I have been a volunteer in the past at the homeless shelter, and I think what we need to do is provide shelter and food for everyone in our community, which would eliminate the need for them to sleep on sidewalks and to have a sleeping ban.
Mm-hmm. But until that great day comes, we have a law in Santa Cruz, and I presume, I think there's a certainly a policy in Scotts Valley, and probably an ordinance. I know there's, maybe Scotts Valley is one of the, they simply have a police practice of not allowing homeless people to sleep at night if they find them in vehicles.
That's wrong.
I would certainly agree with that.
And then, you know, another field that I'm an activist in two arenas. One is disabilities and the other is as an abolitionist. But something we don't may not know is that many people who are homeless as a result of neurological impairments. And they might, many people have mild to moderate head injuries, and those things aren't apparent. They're able to be dressed in ambulatory. They're out among us. But the ramifications of those kind of problems make it difficult for them to make good decisions. They also may lose inhibitors where they do behaviors that the rest of us wouldn't do. And they fall into homelessness. And then it's not a big drop into the penal system. And the largest mental health facility in the United States is the Los Angeles County Jail. So we have to look at who comprises this homeless population and what kind of problems do they have. And punishing people who have physiological or neurological problems, mm-hmm.
or housing problems.
This is barbaric. Mm-hmm. You know, what are we doing?
Well, we had an example of our local police responded to a man named Happy John Dine in November of 1997, who was sort of one of our happy hippies. Sort of, I don't know if you ever knew Happy John. I don't know how much time you spend downtown in Santa Cruz. He was shot dead by Officer Connor Carey for allegedly brandishing a weapon, a toy gun, and the story kind of changed from time to time as we move from the DA through the police chief. Actually, the police chief and the DA have kept a pretty consistent story, which has been refuted or denied by all non-police witnesses. And we've had no response by the Citizens Police Review Board for an independent investigation. Mm-hmm. They simply upheld the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And Happy John was not a homeless man, but he was an activist who is associated with homeless causes, like the City Hall Sleepers protest, where for 8.5 months homeless people slept in front of City Hall,
mm-hmm.
trying to awaken the conscience of the community to change the law that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep, to affect then-Mayor Mike Rodkin, who, by the way, will be on next week on this show from 6 to 6:30 in a debate, or I should say the preliminary to a debate. He can only give us half an hour then. We'll have him for half an hour, and then we will be the week after. 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be debating him for 2 hours. I think it'll be me, although I'm trying to get Keith Sugar to agree to debate him. Keith Sugar is a council member in Santa Cruz, as is Rodkin, who takes a different view of the sleeping ban, a much more healthy view of, sees it for what it is, a punitive law against poor people.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I keep focusing on the sleeping ban, which is really kind of an idiotic law, which doesn't really, it's one of those strange laws you hear people say, well, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's illegal to raise raspberries, you know, and you know, on church grounds or some strange law left over from the Middle Ages. But the passion with which someone like Councilmember Mike Rodkin defends this law, and Catherine Byers, mm-hmm. our mayor, defends this law, there's just no place for homeless people to sleep, says Catherine Byers. Looking at the Santa Cruz area, of course, such a statement is preposterous. But the fact that she can make such a statement in the political climate that exists, similar perhaps in absurdity to the notion that one can claim that capital punishment is a deterrent.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not an expert. If I'm to believe the literature you give me, I mean, I'm sympathetic to it. All my life I've been opposed to capital punishment. It's been a kind of a something I've believed. And I guess another question I want to ask you about that is, you first heard about this case a couple years ago.
This case?
Yes.
When did I first hear about the Cooper case?
Yes.
I heard about it a year ago. 1 year ago this month, I wrote Kevin Cooper the first letter. I was just going to be a pen pal to brighten his day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to write him about bathing dogs and growing zinnias and those sorts of things. And he wrote me back and he said, "I'm innocent, please help me." And I thought, my God, what can I do? So I just ignored that. I wasn't in any way prepared to get into that. And I just wrote him another letter about bathing dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And after about three of those kinds of letters, he sent me about 400 pages of legal documents. And I got that and devoted the rest of that day to reading these documents. And with absolute horror, I realized that it's a real strong possibility that Cooper was innocent.
So you've read the transcript of his trial?
I've read thousands of pages of documents at this point.
Including his trial?
Yes.
And I guess what you cited as making the strongest case is the resistance of authorities to DNA testing, the hair you mentioned that was in the fingers of the victims.
All circumstantial evidence.
Was the jury questioned afterward as to why they decided what they decided? If you've read the trial, why do you think they made those decisions? Was it simply racial prejudice? Was the jury black and white both?
Jury was white. The opening day of the trial, and there was a change of venue to San Diego. A monkey was hung from the San Diego courthouse with a sign attached to it that said, "Kill the nigger." I think that the community was convinced that because Cooper was a convict and because he had escaped from prison, that he was the kind of person that would commit this crime. The prosecution described him as a desperate man who broke into this house because he needed money for his escape, although there was all kind of folding money left in plain sight in this house. Nothing was stolen, no valuables were taken. He was vilified, and it was an all-white jury, and white people again had been killed, and he had a weak person who represented his defense. During the course of this trial, someone in Vacaville Prison indicated that he knew some information directly about the Ryan murders. And a police detective traveled up to Vacaville and interviewed this man named Riley, whose cellmate was a man named Coon. And Riley knew specifics. He knew about the bloody overalls. And he had no connection to Cooper. He knew things that you couldn't know if you weren't really connected to somebody who did this crime. And that information was presented to Negus, who was Cooper's defender at the time, public defender, and Negus took a one-hour break, looked at this information, and did nothing with it. Never brought it to the jury, never investigated it. Years later, when asked why he did that, you know what he said? He didn't remember.
I cannot recall, as one of our famous presidents once
right.
put it.
I cannot recall.
Not a public defender.
Right.
I am a public defender.
During the course of Kevin's appeals, the various attorneys who were assigned to defend him asked over and over again repeatedly to be removed from the job of being his defender. One of them did absolutely nothing for 10 years, and his failure to do anything brought Kevin Cooper within 5 days of execution. The judge said, "Look, if you don't do anything, we're going to move on with this execution." And still, the public defender didn't do anything. And another person stepped in. Another attorney, Jeannie Sternberg, stepped in and wrote a petition, and the judge granted a stay of execution.
But, that's nice of Jeannie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It really was. I mean, she's one of the good people, Jeannie Sternberg is. And imagine if you're in this position of being innocent and having these incompetent defenders, and there's really nothing you can do about it. I think I gave you a transcript of a phone interview I conducted with Cooper, which he talks about, you know, how. I mean, I don't even know what words we can use to describe being in this position where you want so desperately for someone to do something or listen to you, and that you have no recourse.
Have you, you know, there's currently a murder case going on, or there was, the Chillicothe murder case.
Yes, here in Santa Cruz?
Yeah,
we had
some call-ins from a woman named Kitten Reynolds who claims to know the defendants, is concerned about their innocence. Some of us regard Ken Reynolds as a police informant, others regard her as unstable, others regard her as, you know, accurate in some matters, not accurate in others, who knows. Have you spent much time, are you interested in spending much time around local cases?
Possibly. I'm a member of Death Penalty Focus, which is a local group, and we have seen an overview of that case and wrote a letter asking the DA not to seek the death penalty. For a couple of reasons. One is that we just inherently think that it's wrong, and secondly, it's very expensive for the community. Again, no expense is spared in a capital case, so it's going to cost this community an awful lot of money. We think it's the right thing to do is seek life in prison without parole. And, you know, people fear that that doesn't work, but I want to tell you, Robert, that in the 25 years that we've had life in penalty without parole, life in prison without the possibility of parole in the state of California, no one has ever been released. So it's not that people are sentenced that way and then get out. And that's
about
the community fears
they've
that.
They've killed guards or people, other people have died again through continued murders in jail and so forth. Has that happened?
I don't understand the
convicted
question.
Murderers who have been held in jail killed people again in jail.
Yes. Sure, and people who were convicted of murder have killed people in jail. And the guards kill prisoners and all that sort of thing happens.
But only
yes.
in their best interest.
That's right. Last year, the state of California paid out a $2 million lawsuit to a family whose loved one was killed in the yard at San Quentin. He was on death row. It's real dangerous to go out in the yard.
Yeah, I've actually interviewed prisoner Miguel Balderas, a black man who was a man of color who was, I guess it was in Corcoran, he was being held, and he pointed out the guards used to hold these fights, and they would do bets, and they would shoot at you, and it was pretty exciting stuff, particularly if you were 50 miles away watching.
Yes. Now, there was an investigation of those abuses at Corcoran. Being in prison is hell. You know, we don't need to send people to prison to be punished. Being in prison is punishment. It's sensory deprivation. It's lousy, crummy food. It's hot as hell in the summer. It's cold in the winter. It's
bad television most of the time.
Bad television. And Cooper says to me, if you think that having television is some joy, he said, I see these beer commercials and I know I'll never drink a beer. I see these women in bikinis. I know I'll never have a woman.
It's separation from your family, and of course it is an additional punishment for the family. Unfortunately, we can't go into this now because I've got many important things to do on my show here. Actually, not so. You've got very important topics here. We're talking with Jody Kramer about capital punishment, life in prison, and the case of Kevin Cooper. And you've already given us, Jody, some places you can get information, but give us your number again for those who want to get in touch with you, and I hope we can have you back again.
I would be delighted to.
Let me give you a couple minutes to finish up any points you want to make.
Okay. Thank you. I'd be delighted to come back. These are very complex issues, and we've just barely touched on many, many of them. Maybe I could come back sometime and we could talk just about the prison industrial complex and what's going on in that, or, you know, take one of these things and look at it a little bit more in depth.
Or if you can find some local cases that you want to look into, that would really be particularly interesting.
Okay.
To me, because, I see a lot of resources going for cases that are far away, and I'm glad that is happening. But I also think it's important we pay some attention to our own community
yes.
and our own jail.
We can be proud of the fact that currently there is no one on death row in San Quentin from the county of Santa Cruz.
Keep watching.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we have this case that's pending, but we don't currently have anyone from Santa Cruz that's on death row. For those who are interested in becoming involved in the abolition movement, Death Penalty Focus meets the third Thursday of every month at 7 o'clock at Loudon Nelson. It's a really together group. It's profoundly moving, and we'd invite you to come and visit and see what we're doing. If you want to reach me through email, I'm at jody@activist-etc.org. Also have the website www.activist-etc.org.
Do you want to give a phone number, or is that
a phone number? Yes, 438-5357 for people who would like to call and speak to me on the telephone.
438-5357. And if anybody's missed any of this stuff, please give a call to 423-HUFF if you want to get any of this repeated. I want to really thank you again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
You're sharp as a whip, and you got lots of information. I want to have you come back and give us some more.
Thanks. Anytime.
Thank you. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobespierre's Broadside Civil Rights for the Poor, and hopefully a few rights for the rest of us, too. I'm going to be running because I'm going to kind of be playing dueling phone calls. I'm hoping to hear back from an anthropologist in San Francisco. That's probably her right now. Oh, boy.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio?
Yep.
It's Mr. T.
Operation Homeless.
Yes.
And while I'm calling back, I meant to tell you I'm still working on that homeless project thing.
That's good. Listen, you're going to have to talk to me about it another time because we're really pressed for time. But when when you get some results, I want to hear more about it.
I sure will.
Thanks a lot.
I'm going to get you tomorrow, too.
All right.
And sorry to rush Mr. T off like that, but I want to get on with this before I run out of time. This is a flyer that was actually apparently put into the Metro by person or persons unknown. It's a two-pager. On one side it says, it's a kind of a, has a story, theater incident sparks probe. This is from the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Sheriff Sergeant reassigned during internal affairs investigation. It's about a Sergeant Joseph Hemingway who apparently was found with his pants open at the New Art Theater in Monterey County, apparently a porno theater. I got no problem with having one's my pants open. I do it all the time. Well, when I can, you know. But and even if I were a police officer, I would say that certainly is part of the police officer's Bill of Rights. But I guess the concern here is that this particular officer, a Sergeant Hemingway, has been instrumental in harassing youth in Aptos. And this sort of aroused the ire of Richard Quigley, who's a freedom fighter, as I call him, a man who's concerned about basic rights for particularly poor people, young people, and for all of us as well. He wrote this story, which somebody put into the Metro in a sort of a series of inserts, not as a letter, but as a sort of a piece of paper that was inserted manually into the Metro. It goes like this: white Anglo-Saxon judge to hear case against white Anglo-Saxon male for referring to himself as nigger within earshot of a black African-American. Street minister on trial for protesting discriminatory restraining order. As strange as it sounds, that's the kind of trials the taxpayers are paying for these days in the Santa Cruz County Superior Court. Jerry Henry, a street minister from Aptos, California, has been in a battle with the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office and First Alarm Security Company for the right to exist at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center in what Henry refers to as Craptos, California. It's a turf war with the local gang being the cops. This latest episode in Henry's life started about 4 years ago when Henry went to the Safeway grocery store in the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center and found himself confronted by a First Alarm security guard when he stopped briefly outside the store to roll and light a cigarette. Henry's refusal to move on, then or now, has led to some of the most unbelievable abuses of police power and authority ever leveled at a single individual. In the last 4 years since the first assault by First Alarm, Henry has been thrown out of the shopping center under threat of arrest 4 times, arrested 3 times, charged with 7 separate misdemeanors, all bogus trespassing charges eventually dropped, and is now awaiting arraignment for a violation of California Penal Code 415.3, disturbing the peace by using, quote, fighting words. Henry is the victim of a protective order obtained by the Aptos Roasting Company on the basis that his mere presence in the area in front of the coffee shop caused the manager, Dan Eberhardt, to have sleepless nights and heart palpitations. Nothing more. On November 20, 1997, Superior Court Judge Samuel Stevens found Eberhardt's mental frailties so severe, he banished Henry from the front of the coffee shop area, at the time the social center of the Aptos community. Henry made no threats and posed no actual danger, as the statute requires, but Judge Stevens issued the restraint anyway. After all, the attorney for the roasting company seeking the order was the wife of one of the other judges. That's Charlotte Attic, folks, for those of you who know Judge Attic. Stevens couldn't very well say no to her, could he? Politics is politics, right? Henry knows well where the line is that he is not to cross. Stevens went to the shopping center and identified the boundaries of the restraining order personally, a line in the concrete located almost directly in front of Rancho Liquors, next to the roasting company, but out of the line of sight from the roasting company, marks the territory Henry is not allowed to cross. Jerry sees the restriction of his movements in the shopping center as little different from the restrictions imposed on Rosa Parks in Birmingham, Alabama, over 30 years ago. Henry recognizes the bigotry against his disability which brought about his banishment and declares his frustration with his lot in a myriad of different ways. Anyone walking by the location where Henry has maintained a virtually daily protest for the past year and a half will hear his occasional rants, the effects of the frustrations of a disabled man being forced to sit at the back of the bus, as he puts it. Some folks who don't understand all that has happened ask why he doesn't just move on, to which Henry replies, to where? I couldn't get to Mars if I wanted to. This nigga tired, he protests, tired of sitting at the back of the bus. This nigga tired. First alarm security guard apparently overheard Henry in the middle of one of his nigga tired rants and went to the sheriff's substation and complained. Sergeant Joseph Hemingway, the substation commander and a longtime bully who regularly exceeds the bounds of his authority and human decency to abuse Henry, realizing that allegations of some crimes are so heinous that even innocence is no defense, filed a complaint with the district attorney accusing Henry of calling the black African-American, Hemingway's description, security guard, a nigger. The DA elected to prosecute, and I think he may have pulled back on that. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Yes, Mahatia speaking.
You're back. Well, it's good to have you again. I was racing to do another story, but it looks like I'm going to have to let that one pass.
Please, please. Can you
call again in about 10 minutes?
Sure.
Why don't you, let me have you call again in about, actually, if you can call in 15 minutes, that would be ideal.
No problem.
All
talk
right.
To you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Now, that was obliging. In about 15 minutes, we're going to have the conclusion of an interview earlier in the show. From a woman who has been twice to Kosovo, is an anthropologist, and apparently is quite knowledgeable in the history of the area, and has a very definite perspective on why NATO is dropping the bombs it's dropping. I'm concerned also, of course, about what's going on in our local war on the poor, and that's what I've been reading you about. Essentially, the case of the harassment of a man named Jerry Henry, who works with Feed the People, a group that feeds people, poor people in Santa Cruz and elsewhere, food, free food. Actually, it's kind of been moribund for the last couple months. We reported on how Jerry Henry has had his driver's license taken away from him for alleged mental instability, and he immediately went to the DMV for a hearing, and an unprecedented move, got it back on the same day when the hearing examiner found there was absolutely no justification for it. It was clearly some kind of punitive move by the local sheriff's department. And what interests me about this case is, first, of course, the injustice that one man is suffering. It's an important thing to deal with these injustices one by one as they come up, because this man is also a person who, Jerry Henry, who advises young people of their rights, and that apparently is one of the reasons he's being singled out by merchants and deputies out at the Rancho Del Mar Apto Shopping Center. And also to show the corruption in our police department and justice system that really impacts all of us, not just young people out there, not just him, but you and I, if we run afoul of these men with badges and guns and inflated senses of their own authority. Continuing to read this brief story, it's pretty well written, I think. So here's Jerry Henry accused for saying this nigga's tired, referring to himself, of some kind of hate crime or fighting word speech by a security guard, obviously, in another attempt to harass Henry. Thus, Henry may well have the distinction of being the first man ever put on trial for referring to himself in a politically incorrect manner, the first man, white or black. Henry's arraignment is scheduled for 8:30 a.m. May 7th. He was already arraigned. They elected to proceed with charges, by the way, but the latest kind of scuttlebutt is, and it's not completely confirmed, that they're going to back off this one, that it's obviously so thin that you can see through it a mile away. One thing's sure, there'll be an absolute shortage of witnesses against Henry. Everybody knows he doesn't confront people and hasn't a racist bone in his body. Did I mention Henry is a street minister? What's with Hemingway? It's not really fair to judge a man on the basis of a single incident, is it? On the reverse side of this flyer is a copy of an article published in the Santa Cruz Sentinel on January 28, 1995, which explains why many people refer to Hemingway as Pee-wee Hemingway. It was after Henry started passing out this flyer, again, which shows that Sergeant Hemingway was caught with his pants down in a porno theater, and apparently didn't suffer too much consequence for it, and nor should he. Nor should he. That's his own business, as far as I'm concerned. It was after Henry started passing out this flyer that Hemingway made his first dramatic move against Henry. On April 1st, 1999, Henry's driving license was suspended by the DMV as a result of a report filed by Hemingway indicating that Henry was an unfit and unsafe driver and requesting the immediate suspension of his license. The DMV, of course, applied. However, on April 26, 1999, a DMV hearing officer gave Henry a chance to defend himself, and Henry's license was reinstated on the same day with an apology from the hearing officer for what had happened. Hemingway showed up late and shaky. He said it was because of, quote, medication he was taking for a sinus infection, and failed to convince the hearing officer that he was justified in seeking the suspension of Henry's license. During the period of the suspension, over 400 boxes of food were not picked up and delivered by Henry to the local kitchens to feed the homeless. The food distribution portion of Henry's ministry has been all but shut down by Hemingway's tactics. Now, instead of picking up and delivering food to the homeless, Henry is preparing for his arraignment, and did indeed prepare, facing up to a year in jail and over $1,000 fine. It seems the best role model Sheriff Mark Tracy could find to command the Aptos Community Service Center, Sergeant Hemingway, has a pathetic agenda, a personal vendetta, if you will. The only question is whether it is Pee Wee's or Sheriff Tracy's or both. Time will tell. It always does. This flyer was inserted in the current, actually last week's Metro, and the response to the Metro was to write this little story on page 11 of the current issue. Some of our Aptos readers may have been shocked last week to pick up an issue of Metro Santa Cruz only to find an annoying flyer stuffed inside. On one side was a reprint of an old Sentinel article, bad enough, and on the other, the inane, racially charged ramblings of someone named Richard Quigley. No, we did not insert this flyer into our newspaper, and if we find out who did, we'll flog him first and ask questions later, or maybe prosecute him to the full extent of the law. Of course, this shows that the Metro has no understanding of what the First Amendment means, which is the right to pass on information, and if they don't like what he writes, that's their affair. And secondly, of course, it's not racially charged at all. It simply shows abusive behavior by official authorities, something that the Metro has never been terribly interested in uncovering in either of our local police department or our sheriff's department. We're now going to hustle in a very quick call to Richard Quigley, the man who wrote that article and the man who is being maligned in the Metro, to get his perspective on all this. And hopefully we can do that and still get in a few minutes of talk with Marie up in San Francisco on Kosovo. So stay with us.
And we're ringing Richard now.
Hello.
Hello, Richard Quigley.
Oh, Mr. Norris, how are you?
I'm good. You're live on the air on Free Radio Santa Cruz, so watch out.
Okay, yeah, I know.
All right, then. Well, you know, we just read your article, which some good Samaritan inserted into the pages of the Metro.
You mean that inane, racially charged rambling?
Yes,
thing?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh. Well, what do you think?
Well, I found it quite concise, and not up to my high standards, of course. My own writing is so immensely superior, but no, I thought it was quite articulate, and frankly, I didn't really find it racially charged. I found that somebody was using the race card to harass an individual, and that was quite interesting. But I guess, I want to ask you: have you had further contacts with the Metro and talked to them about why they who apparently in the Metro is it Kelly Luker? Is it some other John Ewell? I don't know who's writing this. One never does with this column. This isn't.
Oh, you mean that critique of my work?
Yes. Yes.
I'm not really certain who did that. I had a kind of interesting phone call yesterday morning, though. Before I knew about this, I got a call. Kelly, what did you say?
Kelly Luker is the author of. She's pretty famous. She's attacked me rather savagely in past articles, as some will do.
Really?
Oh yeah.
She called up yesterday. Seems like a rather charming young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's both a looker and an articulate in her way.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh. Anyway, so she...
Could be wedding bells in this for you, Richard.
Oh, yeah, right. anyway, she called up yesterday and wanted to conduct some sort of interview. And, of course, you know me. The last time I knew something I wasn't willing to tell anybody that asked, I don't even remember what it was, so... One of the joys of having a bad memory is I don't have to bother myself with making up lies. So I was pretty straight with the lady all the way through. It was kind of interesting, though. The point of her call came probably 10, maybe 15 minutes into the conversation. Because I've been in and around the political game, when somebody calls me up and tells me we're there with a publication, I generally, you know...
Alarm bells start to ring?
Well, I point out to them that I've never had a reporter get things right yet, so... Are we going to try, or should we just head on out and see what comes up?
I don't think this is going to be a first time, unfortunately, but go ahead.
I don't either. But I don't expect anything. I don't know what to expect. But we talked about all kinds of stuff, and she had a fair amount of information about some of the details of my arrests and the number of times I've been in court and involved in different lawsuits and stuff like that. And I think she was a bit surprised to find out that I was the person that designed the Santa Cruz County Law Library, and I think that...
The website.
Yeah. And, I didn't say that right. Anyway, yeah, the website for the Santa Cruz County Law Library, and then, of course, she went to my website and was indicated that she was duly impressed. But anyway, in the conversation, about 10 or 15 minutes, she mentioned something about, asked me straight up if I was the person that had stuck these into Metro News, you know.
And we should clarify again for the audience, this is a double-sided 8.5 by 11 page, pretty nicely laid out. One side, it's a reprint of a Santa Cruz Sentinel article from 1995 about Sheriff Hemingway's, pantsless activities, or pants-down activities.
But it doesn't matter. There's insufficient evidence for indecent exposure.
Right. Well, I don't... I mean, you know, I'm...
They call him Pee-wee, you know.
Well, I don't know if that's fair enough. Maybe we should call in the sergeant himself to do some measuring here.
Well, no, I don't know whether the reference has to do with the fact that he couldn't get busted for indecent exposure, or because it was, you know, Pee-wee Herman. I never figured out which of the two it was. And certainly, I don't think that he and I are in a position to chat about it, so I doubt that I'll be able to ask him directly.
Anyway, this flyer was apparently placed into hundreds, if not thousands, of metros, which is a free publication, and as far as I know, it can be, you know, I mean, I don't see anything illegal about placing a flyer inside the metro. Maybe I'm missing some obscure law, but it seems to me that that's something you have a right to do.
Yeah, she asked if, in fact, I had done that, and... you know, I wonder about questions like that. When people think you're a liar, I don't know why they ask the question. I mean, just unless they just want to hear the lie. And if they don't think you're a liar, then I guess it makes sense to ask the question. But I get the distinct impression she probably thought that I was probably incapable of telling the truth. Anyway, you know, sneaky people generally tend to judge other people by themselves, so... I was sort of a little bit behind the eight ball there going in. Anyhow, no, I told her straight up I didn't have anything to do with that, that I found out about it after the fact. I really wasn't very, I didn't spend a lot of time and energy on it because, I'm innocent. I didn't think anything of it, to be honest with you. When she asked me about it, it's like, no, I didn't do that. And then I figured there would be no reason that I could see that she would have reason to believe that I had. But as I look back on the conversation, it occurs to me that probably the whole focal point of the entire conversation had to do with perhaps...
Setting you up for that question.
Yeah. And so, okay, you know, all right, whatever. It's her loss, because I think there's a lot more said yesterday that could be a lot more use to the community than her evaluation.
Well,
whether or not I told the truth about stepping him. But no,
always.
I didn't do it. My personal feeling is that I do know who did, and she asked me that specifically, and I told her that I thought she ought to ask him. But it's not one of those things that I would encourage. I had no idea that it was going to happen. It seems somehow unethical to me. I don't know what the legal ramifications are, but personally, I think it's a little highbrow for the publication.
Yeah, I think you may be kind of distributing pearls before the oink-oinks here.
Well, if they saw it as inane, racially charged rambling, mm-hmm. Inane, that has to do with sort of brainless.
Well, you know, I think you're giving them too much credit. You're actually investigating the content of the words they're using as though they were using them in some thoughtful way.
Oh, she was just trying to lay something pejorative on me. It didn't matter what it was.
I think she, you know, I've seen similar phrases used to apply to a person like myself. Mostly my homeless activist work, which they don't think much of, or let's say I've had this long-standing battle with the Java House. Actually, not a battle. They have tried to arrest me for coming into the Java House for trespass. But they bar me from that cafe.
Really?
Oh yeah, because I supported old activist Wonton Dave Jacobs way back in the late early 90s, a sleeping ban advocate. And I wrote about how they kicked him out and how unfair that seemed to me. And they apparently claim that they have hooked me up with some graffiti on the bathroom wall. This is a wall covered with graffiti that said, "Let Wonton Dave Jacobs back into the Java House." And I asked them, you know, did they take handwriting samples or perhaps a fingerprint analysis, or was there a camera, you know, looking in there that caught this, or you know, or perhaps a clairvoyant was doing this, and are they going after all the other people who wrote on their bathroom wall? It's kind of uncomfortable for me tonight because I have to go to the Java House tonight to meet people, and there's a meeting about the Sam Farr thing tomorrow, the 1 o'clock sit-in in Sam Farr's office to stop the bombing, which you're invited to, by the way, as is everyone else, and I'm going to have to deal with the Java House and, you know, either sit outside wrapped in a blanket having my coffee on the sidewalk or go somewhere else. But anyway, I think, yeah, Kelly Luger got into that whole thing herself. And
that's really sad because, you know,
that's how that happened.
When I came here in 1979, I can remember the young woman that brought me here, and it was a young woman, took me downtown. This is 79, I think, 78. Took me downtown to the Santa Cruz Mall. And I was kind of redneck from Arizona, been living down in Southern California, had avoided, you know, any sort of cultural experience beyond that little plastic world. So when I had the mall down there, it was like, whoa, I'm scary, I think. You know, I mean, it was really weird to me. That all that behavior was weird. But it never occurred to me to ban those people's existence, you know? And over the course of the last 20 years, of course, thank whatever, I have managed to, I think, adopt the spirit that lived in the community at that time relative to the acceptance of, for lack of a better word, oddities.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remain confused, if not more than ever, about this banishment,
which apparently
of people from businesses.
It's now being tried out at the Aptos Shopping Center.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly what we're running into down there. And I look at that, and it's like, I don't think that those people understand that they operate as a matter of license. And that license is permission from the people at large for them to do business. And
my problem now, though, is I'm going to have to banish you from the airways because I have a long-distance call coming in from San Francisco from a woman who's very articulate on the issue of Kosovo. And you forgive me, maybe we can pick up this conversation on Sunday when we come back at the 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon show. Maybe
that'd be fine. I do have one thing to give you in parting before you get there, but check with the lady about Kosovo.
Uh-huh.
I think what you'll find is that in Kosovo, they had, as Yugoslavia, and before they were liberated, and nothing changed with the liberation, I believe they had pretty intense gun control.
Hmm, interesting.
I don't think they had the similar rights to what was intended by the Second Amendment. And ask her what she thinks might have happened if the rights that everybody wants to shut down in this country had been available to the people in Kosovo, and they were, in fact, you know, they had weapons in their homes, if she feels that this whole thing with the Serbs would have been quite so easy to pull off, because that's one of those little things I'd like to know the answer to.
Well, I will, if I can,
well, I mean,
in that question.
Not to pick the subject, but if it comes by that way.
Sure.
Because that's always fascinated me. And you're having a peace, sort of a peacenik sit-in tomorrow at Farr's office?
There is a peacenik. Get your butt out, please. No more bombing in Yugoslavia.
What a great idea.
You're invited to come and to bring any rednecks you know with you.
There were some folks down there from some alliance out in front of the courthouse here about a week ago, and they had with them a singer by the name of, last name is King, I believe. And they were quite good, and it was an excellent demonstration. I went down there and sat in and watched most of it. Unwanted, just soon somebody that looked like me would go away, but it was kind of interesting.
Well, I will, provided you bring your Fuck War t-shirt, I will personally sit next to you.
Ah, yes. God, they're in storage, man. I sold so many of those when we
I gotta go, Richard.
I'll talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
And that was the inimitable, and I mean inimitable, Richard Quigley. This is the fairly inimitable Robert Norris, and you're tuned to Bathroom Spears Broadsides, the final 10 minutes. I hope we can get a call back from our San Francisco, Kosovo person. If not, we're going to have to hopefully try to get her to call in on Sunday. Again, there is an ongoing event at the Pacific Cultural Center, the MOVE Forum, 6:30 to 9:30 tonight. That's at, let's see, Seabright and Broadway.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Yes, this is my Pierre calling.
You are back. I'm glad to have you. Now let's pick it up because we only have about 10 minutes.
Okay.
So what did you want to tell us that you have not been able to tell us before?
Well, I wanted to go back to this important document that has been released in the April 24th in the Junge Welt in Germany, which is an internal document coming from Fischer Ministry, which is the foreign office in Germany, and coming also from various regional administrative courts in Germany.
The nub of this document, as I remember it, Marie, is that there is insufficient evidence to indicate any kind of genocide happening in the Kosovo region of Yugoslavia.
Before the bombing started.
Before the bombing started.
Very important.
Mm-hmm. And why was this why did this issue come up for this German agency?
I don't know precisely, but what's important,
I think it had to do with the refugee status of Albanians in Germany, actually. That's my understanding, that in order for there to be, you know, established refugee status, they had to establish there was some kind of persecution going on, and the various investigations led this German agency to believe there was not, which, you know, if I'm to play devil's advocate, I'd have to say government bureaucrats would prefer to find reasons why people cannot be allowed in the country. So there may be, there's something to be considered there, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think this would work in the case...
I'm not saying that it's not accurate, but I'm saying that may be a consideration.
It would be a consideration if the information I'm about to release to your auditors were for the period concerning after the bombing. But it isn't. It was before the bombing. So I think that's why it's very important, and they are very legitimate in this debate.
But what I'm saying, though, is that it seems to me to be in the interest of the bureaucrats compiling this report to say, oh, no, there's no persecution going on in Yugoslavia. You don't got no justification for coming in here. You know, stay in Yugoslavia. There's no real persecution there, whether there is or not. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure I am having your point, because this report from the that I wanted to share,
mm-hmm,
was about saying if there was ethnic cleansing and genocide
no.
Before the bombing.
Right. No, I'm pointing, and I'm saying that I'm indeed in the period before the bombing. A lot of us feel that there was no policy of ethnic cleansing, that there was no policy of going after the KLA and trying to, and indeed, you know, burning houses in villages where the KLA was centered and so forth, perhaps, or rousting people from those houses, but only as a function of the Civil War, and that,
mm-hmm,
that the evidence, one of the pieces of evidence for this would be the fact that this German report says, no, there was no ethnic cleansing before the bombing. What I'm saying to you is that report, the accuracy of that report may be compromised by the fact that German bureaucrats don't particularly want to let in Albanian refugees anyway, and so it's to their interests not to let them in to say, well, there's no ethnic cleansing, so we don't have to let you in.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. But I think nobody is discussing today that there is probably ethnic cleansing in Kosovo happening since the bombing has started. And it's true that there are refugees who have no place to go, and they are not only ethnic Albanians. You have all the other nationalities, and there are more than 20 different ones in Yugoslavia who are also targets of the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I guess about these documents, and we're going into, we have 6 minutes left here, and I'm going to take every second of my 6 minutes. Is there something more you want to say about these documents that we haven't said, which is namely, and I think it's not necessarily unpersuasive, which is that the German, you know, an official German agency certified no ethnic cleansing going on, you know, a period of time prior to the bombing, that wasn't happening, and that seems to contradict the claims of Clinton, and I don't know, what does the UN say about this? Have you examined UN, or I guess the UN is one of the agencies involved here, isn't it? And this, I think one of the UN High Commission had some comments that there was no, it didn't rise to ethnic cleansing, or there was, I'm not sure about the UN. Do you have any sense of that?
The UN has, to my knowledge, I don't know if they have comments on ethnic cleansing before the bombing. I don't think there is any evidence of that coming from the UN either.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you in touch with people in Kosovo? I've heard rumors that the internet was closed down today from Yugoslavia. Is that, do you know anything about that?
No. This is new for me.
That may not be true. No. I know that the Serbian Information Agency was open, so maybe the internet is still open too, but I'd heard that as a rumor.
I'd like to maybe just say one more thing, is that have you heard that there is, you were mentioning earlier, I think, that some of your family were survivors of the Holocaust. And,
I'm sympathetic with survivors. I mean, they weren't in Germany, but they're, you know, they came out of that milieu. They were Jewish, and they were concerned about that. Yeah.
Yes. Noam Chomsky has sent an international appeal from American Jew to the Green Party of Germany lately. I don't know if you've been.
I have read it. It's a great appeal. I like it. I guess. The question I have is I guess, are you going to be at this protest in San Francisco? I know there is a protest scheduled in San Francisco on Saturday.
Exactly. Yes, and that definitely be.
I understand that's a demonstration to stop the war. Mm-hmm. Powell and Market, 1 p.m. for all of you travelers here in Santa Cruz who like to hustle on up to San Francisco. I know the demonstrations have been growing. I've begun to hear reports from Albanians, Albanian refugees, even through mainstream sources, that they're being dislocated not simply by the evil Milosevic, but also by the bombing. Do you have any contacts with Albanians that you'd like to talk about? Any information from them?
Yes, I hear some reports also. I think the situation is very dramatic, and I don't think there is enough food and water that has been airlifted by the West. And I think it seems like the West, as Tom Chomsky was mentioning in his letter as well, that they were more worried to allocate dollars for the bombing than for refugee relief.
Well, those cruise missiles, you know, they give us good jobs here in this country. Let's keep that in mind.
Yeah, and according to the last report today, only 6% of armor and artillery and tanks have been destroyed. So it seems like they are trying to more target, although this is the opposite of what the mainstream media is saying, but it seems like we are targeting much more the non-military targets, because this is what we will have to rebuild. And I think this is really confirming the view I was trying to define earlier in the show, is that this is a
they're finding military names for non-military targets. Infrastructure is a big one.
Yes.
You know, where a bridge is now infrastructure, and I suppose, sure, you know, troops move across an infrastructure. You know, why not just poison the air? I mean, troops also use the air. That'll get rid of the infrastructure too. But obviously the question is, how does it affect the general population of the people that they're supposedly trying to save? I mean, this is a classic destroy the village in order to save a tactic. And it just,
I can only remember the dramatic explosion of the plane of von Braun, the Secretary of Commerce, when Sarajevo was still under the ashes. And it seems like, and with a bunch of, I think he was with a very big, large group of corporate executives who were trying to rebuild Yugoslavia. And it seems like we are attending about the same scenario, and we'll have to send another armada of other corporate executives, and that will help probably recolonize Yugoslavia for good.
Well, you know, that's an interesting word, colonize. That, for example, and the word imperialism were not heard last night in our forum with Norman Solomon, Bill Monag, and Constantine Dinopoulos. They are good liberals who don't use such words, although they seem pretty passionate about, and properly so, about the civilian deaths and about the
Are you trying to say that there is no recolonization of Yugoslavia?
Well, that's what I think what I'm saying is these are words that they didn't use, and I think, no, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that these are words I think we have to consider. These are things we have to consider, and I think that there's still areas that even, you know, opponents who are speaking out, like Bill Monag, have not yet really, they're talking about using the UN to help out, when in fact it was under the auspices of the UN that a lot of this was done, 5 years ago in the earlier situation in Croatia and so forth. It's 8 o'clock. I have got to go. Again, I want you to sign in again so I get your name correctly for those of out there who want to know who you are.
Marie Pierre.
And Marie, how can folks reach you if they want more information? Because you have a lot of it.
My email is cocos@sirius.com. SIRIUS.
And is that sufficient? Do you want to give a number? Do you want to leave it at the email?
Oh, I think the email would be better.
Okay. Then there is an email address for you, and if you didn't get it, call 423-HUFF, and I'll give it to you. Again, we've been talking to a woman who's been to Kosovo and has done more reading than probably five of us put together down here, and please keep us advised. We're going to be going back on the air Sunday between 11 and 1:30. If you want to call back during that time and speak on the air, you're welcome to do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's it for Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I'm out of here, and I'm going to play a little snatch of my music before
you get cut off.
Before I get cut off. No, don't do it. Don't do it.
We need a union to have power. We need a union to survive. We need a union to stand together. We need a union for a better life. Alone, you got nothing. Take whatever's coming. When we unite, we got the strength to fight. We need a union to have power. We need a union to survive. We need a union to stand together. We need a union for a better life.
And we just want to mention your right to a pension, reach your maturity and need security.
We need a union to have power.
Yeah, need a union to survive.
Sisters are here to say, for equal work, they want equal pay. We need a union to have power.
We need a union to survive.
We need a union to stand together. We need a union for a better life.
And when the bosses want profit, they take it from your pocket. They spend your money for their life.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and broadcasting from Santa Cruz, somewhere either underwater, above water, but thank you, Robert. A great show, as always, and it's time now for Earth First Radio, so stand by. The studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's time for Earth First Radio, and I'm Uncle Dennis. Please stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.